This is Alan Etchells, recorded at his home in Ellesmere Port by Chris Eldon Lee on Monday the 15th of June 2009. Alan Etchells, Part 2.
Were the Americans trying to get one over the British, or was Fuchs being...
No, I don't think so. I think it was just the fact that Fuchs didn't trust the Americans to come back and pick our lads up, sort of thing. And he didn't want them stuck out there with no way of getting back. So that's why he proposed that we should put this route in straight from the crossing straight to the Shackleton, sort of thing.
So it wasn't a two fingers gesture. It was
no, I don't think so. No, no.
Safety no. move, anything?
Eh?
Safety move.
Well, it could be, yeah.
But Fuchs strikes me as the sort of person who wouldn't be messed around with. He'd get what he wanted.
Oh yeah.
Let's go back slightly. You were going to the Theorons.
Yeah, that was after the Totten's runs. Then when I was back in UK, the trip went out to Theorons, and they surveyed that and geologised and that. And that took a couple of years, I suppose. And then when I went, first trip I went back, we went via the Theorons because they thought that route would be the best to get to the Shackletons. But in fact, it turned out not to be, really. Going up the Schlesser Glacier was a bit of a pull up there.
Mm-hmm. Was that when he began to run out of sugar?
No, that was another time, actually. That was another trip. Well, it's just the fact that we were getting a bit short on sugar. And I think I was sharing a tent with Pete Noble. And I said we need to cut down on the sugar ration. We were getting a bit short. I said, I think everyone should cut down by half. So he only had one sugar lump, and at the time I was taking seven. So if he cut down by half, then it'd be nothing. But I don't think it actually went that far. I think I cut down by one or two. It's amazing how much sugar you took when you were out there, really. Same as butter as well. You just had these hardtack biscuits and you just coated those with butter, you know, thick.
To make them palatable or because of the energy?
You needed the energy, yeah. Yeah.
Fats.
Yeah. In fact, we didn't get through all our butter, even so. But the doggy men used to come along and take it, our surplus.
For the dogs?
Yeah, well, no, for themselves.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Every man through box for 20 man days. £6 of butter.
Yeah, yeah. And you could get through that, two of you, in 10 days.
Yeah. Were you actually in charge of these trips then?
No, not the Shackleton one. No, that was Pete Noble.
But you were driving.
Yeah, I was driving. Yeah.
So you were driving the International Harvesters. Yeah.
Myself and JC Johnny Carter. Yeah.
Were there any tricks of the road to keep them rolling smoothly and to keep them fueled properly?
No, not really. We had sort of what we call tanker sledges. We put the 45-gallon drums of aviation fuel on the standing up on the sledge and made some frames for them so that they could stand there, and tied them down with wires and turnbuckles. So it meant that if you wanted to refuel, all you had to do was drive alongside the other bloke's sledge and he could refuel without taking drums out or unlashing or anything, just straight from the drum, and he would do the same with you.
Is that the answer you're looking for, is it?
No, they had a 45-gallon drum on the blade of the IH, didn't they?
Ah, that was for weight, yeah.
Tell me about that, sorry.
The IHs... were back heavy, had this big winch on the back, 20-ton winch. Why they put a 20-ton winch on, I don't know. Anyhow, they did. And it was all back heavy, and it tended to go along on a sort of incline. And it would occasionally dig itself in at the back. So for the field work, we decided that we'd put two 45-gallon drums and mount them on the front of the bulldozer blade with wires, just to give it a bit more weight at the front. And that seemed to work okay, yeah.
Your idea?
Well, yeah, more or less, I suppose, yeah.
And they were running on aviation fuel?
Yeah, well, in Halley Bay, it's, everything's run on, well, the Mustangs were petrol, but the IHs and the generators and the base, all on aviation fuel, yeah.
Is that how they were designed, or is that also...
Well, it's just because there's more, less water in it, less water in aviation fuel, so it won't freeze till... Well, it starts freezing about minus 55, something like that, whereas diesel would freeze at minus 10.
Right. So was that an innovation of yours, or were they designed?
No, that was...
They were designed to...
Yeah, that was designed to use that, yeah. Because we had to put engine oil in with the fuel, because it's a dry fuel. The aviation is more dry than diesel. So we needed to mix it with so much engine oil.
And you were mixing it at base?
Yeah, we used to put so much in each drum. Mm. It was not a lot, actually, just a pint or so, I think.
Okay. And once you were out with these international harvesters and you had the balance right, were they good to drive, or was it a rough job?
It was a slow job. 2 miles an hour, I mean.
Really? Yeah. You could walk faster.
You could just about, yeah, walk, yeah. You could certainly keep up with the vehicle, yeah, yeah. At times you used to get out and walk alongside it, you know, just a bit of exercise.
Was that a severe handicap, because it limited your range, I presume?
Well, no, I mean, that was how they were built, and they were pulling in second gear. You couldn't change up to third gear. With those tractors, you put it in a gear and set off, you know. Once you're going, you can't change up. You can't change. If you want to change, you've got to stop the vehicle, put it in the next gear. But it wouldn't pull in the third, in the next gear. So it's a matter of just staying in the second gear. The Mustangs weren't much faster in any case. They only got about 2.5 miles an hour.
Oh, right, okay.
But you were driving 24 hours a day, weren't you?
Yeah.
So just, somebody asleep in the cab, would they?
Well, we had a caboose on the, like a caravan on the back. For cooking and sleeping, relaxing in. And if you didn't mind banging about, you could get to sleep in it when it was moving. But they'd be going over Sestugi, which is quite... It used to go over and then come down with a thump. Actually, on the way back, the wind must have changed direction and it smoothed the surface out. And you could sleep on the way back, you know.
Were these vital expeditions, or were you surveying the area just because it was there? Or was there a secondary purpose? Were you trying to find...
Well, the idea was to get to the Shackleton Range and look at the Shackleton Range. The geologists and surveyors wanted to get there. That was the whole purpose of it. We still put the... markers in each 2 miles and measured those every time we went past, sort of thing.
So the route was already planned out for
whoever. You had your own techniques at geology, I understand.
Well, there's this, we got to Shackleton's and there's this beautiful green mountain, green rock it is. No, that's not it. It's in front room on the windowsill. Yeah. And we decided we'd take some back for the lads on base. So we pulled the vehicle up to it and the sledge and the box on the back and a sledgehammer and knocked hell out of this. Well, we didn't take all that much, really. But there's a few photos knocking about of beautiful rock.
So it's a kind of a green gypsum.
Yeah.
Looking at it now.
Pete Noble's actually got a a thing made for his wife, actually.
A locket?
Polished up, yeah. Yeah, yeah, beautiful, that, polished that, it up, lovely, yeah.
That sample there is about the size of a house brick, isn't it?
Yeah. So we bought a lot back to base, actually.
This would be agricultural geology, would it?
Yeah. Yeah, I could say that.
And do you have your own depots named after you? Depot Dad?
That wasn't a depot for me. It was a depot for the mountains. We depoted all along. That's where we were going along. If we had dogs with them, we used to put a depot in every 50 miles and a vehicle depot every 100 miles. But when we got to the mountains, the whole idea was to get as much stuff out there as we could. And we left the depot there of, I think it was 29 tonnes or something. Yeah, it must be 29 ton, wasn't it? That's where 29 ton came in, yeah.
And that was Depot Dad?
Yeah, that was Depot Dad, yeah.
Did you christen it, or was it christened for you?
No, I didn't christen it. Somebody did.
Mr. Noble.
Mr. Noble, perhaps, yeah. Could have been.
And you also had a mountain named after you as well.
Yeah.
Tell me about that. How did that happen?
Well, when we first went to the shacks, we said there should be, we should have something. And we thought they'd just been named locally, sort of thing. So, because the surveyors used to name peaks and things. So when they were doing maps, they'd put the name on them, a local name sort of thing. And we didn't realise that the names had been taken up by the Antarctic Place Names Committee. But in fact, we found out a couple of years ago, or last year, I think, that he's had. And all the six or five of us that went out there got a mountain named after him.
What's yours like?
I don't know, never seen it. I'll show you a bit of rock. There's a bit of rock there, probably.
Does it feel special to have a mountain named after?
Oh, yeah, Mountain Etchell. Mount Etchell's it's called. Yeah.
But you're the only person in Ellesmere Port who's got a mountain named after them.
It could well be, actually, yeah.
There's a sample here, polished rock.
That was the geologist at Bass. Mount Etchell is 900 metres high, 18 south, and 21 west.
And this sample's a kind of pale yellow and black granite, isn't it, really?
Granite, but it looks like, isn't it, yeah.
Very appropriate.
Okay. There were one or two other incidents that happened in the Antarctic, famous incidents that you were around at the time of. And I'm thinking particularly of when John Brotherhood was evacuated.
Yeah, and I wasn't actually on base at the time. We were halfway up the Schleser Glacier in a tent with John Goldsworthy, and he said, "What's that noise?" I said, "I don't know, sounds like an aeroplane." And that's the only thing we saw. We looked out and there's this aeroplane flying across. We tried to get in touch with base, but the radios we had at the time were pretty useless, so we didn't really know anything about it until found out until we met up with somebody who knew about it.
This was the American plane coming in to pick him up.
Yeah, that was the first time Americans had flown over that far, yeah. They sent two planes over, one to land and the other one to circle around. I don't know what he was going to do if anything happened, but that's the Yanks for you, isn't it? And they said they wanted a runway marking out sort of thing. So they decided on base, they got a hell of a lot of cocoa there, which nobody ever drank. I don't know why. Well, I just didn't know it was there. So Abdul, who was the electrician, he decided that he'd mark the runway out with this cocoa powder. So they went out, a couple of them went out with this cocoa powder and marking this mile or so of runway where they expected the plane to land. But then they landed, the Yanks landed, and just drove up to the base sort of thing, you know, in this big aeroplane. And they said, no, no, we didn't want, it's very good of you to do that, but we didn't want that. All we wanted really was a wind direction. So they've used all our year's supply of cocoa.
Oh, I see, yeah, right.
So they flew over a few days later and dropped this parachute. We thought, oh, they dropped some beer for us. But then they dropped coke to replace it.
And that was the follow-up, was it?
American coke. Yeah.
Again, you give the impression that there was... The British looked down slightly upon American intelligence.
I don't know, really.
Was there any kind of sense of...
I don't think so, really. I don't know. I don't know, really. Don't think so.
It was just
a thing, wasn't it? You know, I always think the Yanks are a bit. Perhaps you don't.
Never have much to do with the Americans.
Well, I haven't really, no.
Were they the butt of jokes?
Yeah.
But in practice, there was cooperation.
Yeah, John Brotherhood's father was an air marshal in the RAF or something, and he got in touch with somebody he knew in the States, and that's how he got the plane over, really.
What other memories do you have of Halley at that time, your second spell at Halley?
What have you got down there?
Well, I haven't, that's why I'm asking the question.
You were the leader of the Black Gang.
Oh, the Black Gang. What's the Black Gang?
Well, it's just the mechanics and electricians. We had our own office in the workshop there, which was very nice, really. We decorated in photos of, I don't know who'd done it all, photos of lightly clad females.
And tell me about Gully's Folly, that's the other note I've got here.
Well, that was the caravan type thing that we took out to the mountains.
The caboose.
The caboose, yeah. Mm. It was mounted on a sledge. And he put six bunks in there. And it had a cooking space at one end. Had a library in there, a little shelf with books on it. That was very good, actually, yeah.
Why Gully's Folly? Why?
Well,
the name.
I don't know where the name originally came from, really. Just the fact that Gully built it or modded it, and the name stuck around.
Gully was one of the team, was he?
He was, yeah. He's a carpenter, actually, yeah.
Right.
John Goldsworthy.
Oh, I see, okay.
He went out with us, yeah.
So you came to the end of your second spell at Halley Bay and time to come back to Britain. Were you leaving with regrets or were you glad to finish?
Well, I suppose so, yeah. We had a good 2 years. It's always a regret to leave anywhere, isn't it, really? You're leaving friends behind that have come in that second year sort of thing. Yeah.
What happened when you got back to Blighty?
Before Blighty, really, we went into South Georgia on the way back. And Bill Sloman was there. And he said, do you fancy a job in the office? I said, yeah. And he fixed me up with... A job on the logistics side, on the technical logistics side.
Mm-hmm. That didn't last long, did it?
No, when I went back then to South Georgia.
So tell me about that. Were you itching to go south again? Were you?
Oh yeah.
What were your feelings at that time?
I really enjoyed it. Yeah, being down there. Yeah. And Bass were taking over from the government at South Georgia. Government wanted to come out, Falkland Island government really were there at the time, administrator, and they wanted to come out and Foreign Office wanted Bass to go in. They said they would do, but they needed some cash sort of thing, you know. So they got 5 million, I think it was.
In 1970?
5 million, yeah, on a going down each year to nothing. Went down 1 million each year for the next 5 years. So they said, under those circumstances, they'd go. Because money was short in those days. So we went in and took over from government, had 4 days, I think it was, take over all the equipment and administration or whatever. And I looked after the jenny shed.
Did you have to apply for that, or were you just... Was it just understood?
Well, they said they needed somebody going to South Georgia, and I said, that's me.
Volunteer.
Yeah.
You were keen to go?
Oh, yeah. And we didn't have a cook, actually.
From you?
Yeah, that was after, though. Yeah. We didn't have a cook at the time. And Dick Stocks said he would go down as the cook. He's an old fit, actually. I don't know what he was, a builder, wasn't he? Builder, carpenter. He said he would go down as a cook, you see. So we said, OK, fair enough. So he went down on the ship with us. He got off the ship and walked up to Shackleton House, where the accommodation was, and into the kitchen. And so it was all electric. It had been built for the Falkland Islanders sort of thing, not for Fidge, you know. It had this big oven in the centre of the room, which used to take about 20 kilowatts to run it all, and had all sorts of equipment, you know, potato peelers, and he said, oh no, that's not for me, and walked out and got back on the ship. Anyhow, Dave Hill, Fanny, was coming up from Adelaide at the time to go home, and so we talked him into staying for the 12 months we were there as cook. But he became more or less my assistant. Well, I don't know where he became my assistant. I became his, actually. Yeah. Yeah.
Describe the base, because it was very different from anything else you'd found the other bases in the Antarctic.
Oh, yeah, well, it was built for single accommodation for the administration stuff at King Edward Point, sort of thing.
For the whaling station.
Yeah. Had single bunk rooms, bedrooms sort of thing, with wardrobes, sink, and all you could have, a writing desk, all you could ask for, really. Hot water, as much hot water as you wanted, because the water was running all the time off the from the dam. Central heating, everything. Big fridges, walk-in fridges. Very good it was. Washing machines galore. But then they decided it was too posh for the Fids, so they put two men into each bunk room. Which was still good, actually. I mean, bunk rooms were as big as this room, sort of thing. So lived in luxury there, really. Had a billiard table, full-size billiard table. Dartboard, a bar.
Film projector?
Film projector, yeah, we had films, yeah, film projector. It was a good year, really.
did it feel like being a Fid, or was it too good to be a Fid?
No, it was good, actually. No, it was very nice, yeah.
You had a running a scientist called Gary Maxwell when you were there.
I didn't really have a run in. He just he wasn't used to my way of working.
What was the problem?
Well, he'd just come down actually on the ship and got a program to do. Oh, and he wanted some equipment making, so he came into the workshop and said, "I want I'd like, well, I did say like, I'd want this doing and this doing and this welding and that doing. So I sent him out, sort of thing, you know. I said, we're not here to do your work, like that sort of thing. So he went to see Ricky Chin, who was the base commander, and complained to Ricky. And Ricky said, well, how did you go? Did you demand it to be done? He said, well, I need it, you know, I've got to be done. I said, but the mechanics aren't here to do your work, they're here to look after the engines and whatever, you know. He said, go and try and say he'll be prepared to cut the metal and things like this, you know. So he came in all apologetic and said he'd... So I said, yeah, fair enough. He'd cut the metal for me if I'd weld it up. I said, yeah, yeah, I'll weld it up, yeah, yeah. So I said, what do you want, sort of thing? And gave him the metal for it to be cut. And gave him this sax saw. Which had very few teeth on it, you know. So he's there. Well, I know for how long, sort of thing. And I went up, so how are you getting on? Well, he said, it's not pretty hard, this metal. I said, yeah. Oh, let's have a look at the axe saw him. Oh, I said, you need a new blade. And they became friends after that. So,
was there a lot of practical joking going on?
Sorry?
Was there a lot of practical joking going on?
Well, I suppose there was a bit, days. Yeah, like that, yeah, yeah, yeah.
You had to lay on the water supply for this new... South
Georgia base. No, that was later on, actually, yeah. That wasn't while we were there.
It wasn't?
No.
It was a summer job we went down to do. Dave Hill and myself.
I see.
I used to go down each summer to see the bases, see they were still there, you know. And they decided they wanted a 3-inch pipe, main supply pipe, put in round from the whaling station, which is about... half a mile away, I suppose, into the King Edward Point where Bass was. And so we decided we'd go down and do it. Dave Hill and myself got the pipe and put a IH in there with a back actor on it and a bucket. And three of us put this pipe in. It was quite a nice job for a few weeks.
It's still being used now?
Yeah, I hope.
It is, yes.
Do you have many visitors on South Georgia? Overseas visitors, foreign visitors?
Quite a few Russian ships came in, yeah.
What were they doing?
They were fishing round about, sort of thing. And they asked permission if they could come in for water, really. And over at the whaling station, the water was still running there. And they used to fill the tanks from there and... I think Bass charged them so much. I don't know how much he charged them, but they did charge them for it, yeah. And then they usually came up to Charlton House and we had a bit of a do at night, you know. Bit of a sing-song and a few jars.
Schnapps? The vodka?
The vodka, yeah. Vodka's very nice, actually, if you get the proper stuff. Mm. Yeah.
Is there a captain that sticks in your memory?
Yeah, yeah, one with the one arm, dear. Yeah, he had one arm. he was a very nice bloke, actually, yeah. And the engineer was a short and tubby chap. I believe Fanny was going to marry his daughter at one time, I think, after they'd been drinking. Got engaged to his daughter.
Oh.
Do you know that?
No. Not really got engaged?
No.
Sorry. What was it? Could you communicate with the Russians? I mean,
the what?
Could you communicate with the Russians, or was it all sign language?
Well, a lot of it's sign language. One or two of them could speak English. Not on that particular ship, but on the big factory ship that came in, they had a how do you call him, commissar sort of thing. He's in overall charge of whatever, and they daren't do anything without his permission, sort of thing. Bit of a rogue, really.
Was the whole kind of whaling fishing business tailing off at that point?
No, it was all starting up.
Was it?
Yeah.
the fishing as opposed to the whaling.
That's before the that's right, yeah. That's before the Falkland Islanders got into it, really. They decided that there'd be a lot of money there. And they registered all the ships in the Falkland Islands. And they bought two fishing vessels, didn't they? Two protection boats.
Did the Fids have much to do with the fishing fleet? Or did you socialise with them?
Well, we socialised when they came in, when we got asked back to their... when they were leaving the following morning, they'd go and let the ropes off and go on board for a breakfast sort of thing, of little tot to see them on their way.
And they have one or two ladies on these special ships sometimes.
Yeah, big ones.
You didn't get engaged in any of those?
No.
So what was the main thrust of the work being done at South George? What was the actual serious side of being there?
They were starting all sorts of programmes, really, weren't they? They were counting seals. Dave Walton? What was he?
It was a greenhouse, though.
Yeah, they built a greenhouse, yeah. And, they had sites which they railed off, sort of thing, and were doing... I don't quite know what they were doing, really. Sites which they were monitoring against the normal area, sort of thing. And they were studying all the plants and the little mites and things. Which they found... I found a lot of mites which I didn't know existed and that sort of thing.
So it was more zoology and botany than surveying?
Yeah, by that time, no, there was no surveying from... Surveying? No, they were checking. There was a party came in to check the water flow off the mountain sort of thing. They were putting little dams in and measuring the flow and that sort of thing. They were catching fish.
Dave Walton was about the botanist.
Oh, yeah, that's right, yeah.
He would have been his greenhouse.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were doing hydrospherics as well.
There was quite a lot of programmes, actually, in the summer period. People used to come down just for that few months sort of thing.
And your job was to make sure they had plenty of power.
Yeah. Well, we hadn't really. We hadn't got that much until we put two new generators in, actually.
Was that your initiative?
Yeah, well, we had to have them, yeah. The old ones were a bit, they'd been there forever and a day, right?
So were they sent down from Britain?
Yeah, two Scanias, yeah. 120 kilowatt, I think.
Did you have any problems ordering those, or were they?
No, there's plenty of firms really that'll build them for you.
I mean, getting permission, arguing the case for them.
I think that was when they still had the extra 5 million, I think, so I think we're okay just then, yeah. Okay. It's the second year after I got there, I think, I decided we'd put a new generator on.
Well, Alan Weirdon is with us, he has set this interview up, and I just wondering how you two met. Was that in South Georgia?
No, that was in Montevideo, actually. I was just walking along the road and he was coming the other way. Is that there?
Not quite. I think it might have been to do with young ladies and hotels.
No. That's the first time we met, actually, was in Montevideo. Yeah.
Was this on one of
your... You were on the ship, weren't you?
No, I'd been in South America.
Oh, you'd...
You were on the ship, and I was joining the ship.
Oh, okay. What year was that, then?
1971,
okay. So this was in your period when you finished your season at South Georgia and you were back in London, but you were travelling backwards and forwards quite a lot, were you?
Yeah, I used to have the summer here and the summer down there.
And why was all that happening?
Well, somebody had to go down and check the bases each year, make sure they were doing what they're supposed to do and check the indents and any engineering problems or whatever, electrical problems. And as time went on, they got more and more equipment sort of thing. I mean, They had desalination plants at Signy, and we rebuilt. We rebuilt Faraday, didn't we?
Yeah, 76.
Yeah, put new generators in all the bases and different years sort of thing. So there's always a lot to do, yeah.
And you were travelling every 6 months?
Yeah, yeah.
How are you getting up and down? The different routes?
Flying mainly. Towards the end, I used to fly straight into the Falklands, but previous to that, I used to fly into South America, and then there used to be a flight across from Mar del Plata. No, not Mar del Plata. Yeah, down into Falklands, yeah. It was the Argentinians that were doing that. Yeah. Used to make it as hard as possible for us, yeah.
Well, in what way?
More for the Falkland Islanders. They had to have a white card or a green card, I forget what colour it was, a white card, I think, to travel, and they'd get to Mar del Plata and they hadn't got this card, and they'd have to go back to BA to get this card to come back to Mar del Plata. They just made it awkward for the Falkland Islanders at the time. And yet they were doing quite a lot for the Falkland Islanders. I mean, they they provided a lot of stuff for the kids at school, and the boats for them and all sorts of things. If they'd just kept up like that, you know, the Falkland Islanders would have accepted them in the end, I suppose. Apart from Velma, of course, she would never have accepted them. she owned the pub there. And,
Who was this?
Velma. Velma Malcolm, her name was. She's dead. She's dead now, yeah.
Velma or Belma?
Velma. Velma.
The V, okay. She was a character, was she?
Yeah, yeah. She married George. He was down there in the army in the war. And came back and then went down again as...
A shepherd,
yeah, he was, yeah, a shepherd, yeah.
And so then Velma was the landlady of the one pub in Stanley?
No, not the one pub, no, the Rose Hotel. But there was about one, two...
Four,
yeah, but there was some right down there near the lighthouse and things, weren't there? At one time, there must be about seven pubs.
Oh, in the end, there was.
Yeah, yeah.
But in those days, only the four.
But the Rose was one of the main ones, the Finch used to go in. That one on the, what's the one off the jetty?
The Globe.
The Globe, yeah.
What was the atmosphere of the Rose like?
They ruled it with a rod of iron. It belonged to Mrs. Johnson, that's Velma's mother. And she was, we had this argument the other day, she wasn't all that big, actually. But she was. She used to stand there at the door at 10 o'clock. It closed. That was it. No drinking up time. Anything. You'd get a gin and tonic. 1 minute, two, and it. You'd have to be up the road at 10 o'clock. And she'd stand at the door and go, and no swearing. Why you swear? Don't you come in here again?
Was that attitude, you think, a response to the clientele, or was that just the way she was?
That's the way she was. Yeah, it was her pub, and she. Yeah. Women weren't allowed in the pubs,
are
they?
No, that's allowed.
No, they were. They used to go in, but it was frowned upon, I suppose, for ladies. There was ladies of the night used to go in, but the other ladies didn't.
Where was the beer coming from?
UK. It was all tins in those days.
The bottles.
Bottles, yeah.
The Rolls used to sell a lot of bottled beer down to the bases.
Yeah. Yeah, in boxes with straw around them. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. There's a boat. The boat there. It's the dredger, actually.
And the ladies of the night.
No, they were more in Monte than Falklands.
There was only one in the Stanley.
Was there? What was the name, Alan?
Yellow Submarine, I think.
Yellow Submarine.
She was a big girl. A bit more like a submarine, actually.
Do you want to elaborate, or is this...?
No, I don't. Alan, he knows more about it.
I know nothing about that.
Did he ever go to the Antarctic via Panama?
No.
Okay.
Bransfield used to go that way, occasionally.
Well, there was a kind of a second... There was a special class, wasn't there, devised later on, called the Superfids, for travelling south. Was that on plane or on...
I thought it was a good idea, actually. Somebody in this room wouldn't say that, but I thought it was a good idea.
What was the idea?
Well, the idea was it got all these people like me and quite a number of people who were going down there year in, year out sort of thing, senior scientists and people like that.
Superfids.
And if you got... If you mess with the fids, not mess with them, but, you know, mess with them, then you had to do everything like the gash and all the rest of it, clean the bugs and all the rest of it. And the idea was that the superfids, as they were, as he keeps calling them, should have been living in the wardroom, really. But you could only get about four guests in the wardroom. There wasn't enough room for anybody. So I decided they would knock two cabins down, a four-man and a two-man, and make this dining room for us senior people who had been down there year in, year out. And I thought it worked very well, actually. We had our own steward. He used to serve the meal, and he used to wash up.
Your own bar, isn't it?
Eh?
Had your own bar?
Had our own bar, yeah. I thought it was a very good idea, really.
So what happened to it, though? Did it not last?
Well, I don't know why it...
They weren't in the same... It wasn't happening. There was that type of people going down on the ship anymore because they just fly.
It was a dentist that shouted about it as well, yeah.
You got some questions, Alan?
It became the computer room eventually on the branch. Yeah.
You got some points that I'm not familiar with.
Well, these were just general ones. You had a motorbike down in South Georgia.
No, yeah, well, first year I was there, when we took over from government, we thought it'd be a good idea to have a motorbike there, yeah. So we got Paul Whiteman in HQ to buy us a bike. Only cheap second-hand rough thing, you know. And they got this one that was 500... It was a Norton frame with a 500 Beezer engine in it. I think it'd been run on... I don't know what it'd been run on, but... It had special oil in it. Why he bought that, I don't know. Anyhow, he did, but... you couldn't go all that far in it, really.
What was it used for? Messages, or...?
No, just for messing about on, really, yeah.
These are really just tally things. Pete, which you went through the sea ice and with the IH and Halley?
Yeah, that was... that must have been after South Georgia, too.
Right, when you were summering?
Yeah, I was down there for the summer. And I don't know whether he was on the ship, he'd come back from somewhere. And there was two vehicles to come back to the ship that were coming back to UK for overhaul. There's a Muskeg with a crane on the back, a Tyco crane, and an IH. And I was just getting these ready at the base, ready to bring one of them back. And he came... past, he said, I'll drive one back if you want. So I said, okay, which one do you want? He said, well, I'll drive the IH, because they'd taken the top of the cab off halfway up. He said, I've got this duvet on. He said, the wind was getting up a bit, it was quite cold actually. He said, I can button this right up, and good job he did, really. And then we started off along we got down to the bottom of the ramp and across the sea ice. We hadn't got a radio with it. The idea was that when you got to the bottom of the ramp, you'd let the ship know and they'd keep an eye on you as you came across the sea ice. It was quite a couple of miles, I suppose, a mile and a half, some sea ice. And anyhow, as we got there, Ken Lax came down in a snowcat. He was going back to his ship. So we said, let them know that when you get there, that we're coming across. Anyhow, we set off and we got, a couple of them, about a quarter of the way across, I think. And he was in front of me on this IH. And suddenly, it had gone, disappeared. Oh, Christ. So I stopped and rushed to where it had gone in. And there's all these bubbles coming up and whatever. I think it was still running, actually. And suddenly this... He popped out, you know. Oh, I thought, bloody hell. Didn't he? He got to the side and we managed to get him out, pulled him out, sort of thing.
You pulled him out?
Well, pulled him out, yeah. They come down and pulled him out. God, he said, oh, my fags got wet. God, it's a good job he went in and not me. His foot had got caught under the one of the brake pedals on the thing. And he went down quite a tight, quite a way, he said, because he looked back up and he could see this hole getting smaller and smaller. And he managed to free himself. And because he had this duvet on, which quite airtight, it trapped air, and he came popping up, sort of thing. So then we said, well, what are you going to do? Well, I don't know, he said. It started getting cold. So there's some skis on the back of the Muskie. And I think there is, actually. I said, why don't you go back to the ship? He said, I said, and before you freeze to death. And he put skis on and went back. And they must have been watching from the ship, because he got halfway back to the ship and the snowcat came and picked him up. And then we had the problem of getting the Muskie across the across this crack. I did quite a lot of probing with the ice chisel, trying to find a safe way across. But in the end, I found that it narrowed a bit and then widened out again. I thought, well, I'll just go for it, you know. So I just drove it across and went back to the ship.
The International Harvester was never seen again, I presume.
They put him in a hot bath, actually.
No, the tractor went down. The tractor went down?
Yeah.
Was that seen again?
No. It's about 600 yards down there somewhere.
That's rubbish in the Antarctic.
You were based at back in Britain. When Bass moved from London to Cambridge. Do you have much memory of that process?
No, not really. No, it didn't really involve us, actually. Except the fact that because we were single people, you couldn't get any of these allowances that all the married families were getting, and, you know, moving house and government things that you get if you're part of the government, you know, moving allowances and all sorts of things. All we got was a fixed allowance of 100 quid, I think.
Did you feel it was better at Cambridge? Was working conditions and life better?
Yeah, the place itself was better, completely better, yeah. Mm. Yeah.
You had a tiny office to start with in Cambridge.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they brought all the units that Bass had, which were all around the country. When we were in London, that was just administration only. And all the units, like the Met, was up in Edinburgh and something else at Aberystwyth. And there was a unit at Sheffield, and Birmingham was geology. And they were all over the country, really. And going to Cambridge brought all these units together, so it was better as far as Bass were concerned, yeah.
Looking back over your time with Bass, Alan, I mean, you've been connected with Bass for a very long time. So how has the kind of the whole ethos of the organisation changed? It sounded very Fred Karner at the beginning. And
well,
what
I don't.
Be the major changes?
I don't think it was Fred Karner so much sort of thing as it was all new to everybody, really. I mean, up till what, late 50s sort of thing, it had been expeditions going down and. But then it became a more permanent, the base became more permanent sort of thing. And they were doing programmes which kept them on base. So they didn't, you know, it was, and we were down there to do the actual travelling, really. I wouldn't really like to go down now, and I think we had the best of it, really, to join the 60s.
It's all a bit staid now, is it?
Well, tends to be, yeah. I mean, I do a lot of travelling from Rother, but it's mostly by plane, sort of, then they get taken out and brought back again by aeroplane. They travel around on skidoos when they're out there, but the actual, whereas in the 60s, I mean, the dog teams from Rotherham were doing, from Adelaide, were doing it. We're doing thousands of miles a year sort of thing, you know. You don't know how much science we're doing, but we're doing a lot of miles.
Your scariest incident? The one that you actually were there at, rather than one you heard about? Was there something which makes you shiver even now?
Yeah, I don't shiver easy, actually.
We never run out of gin, then?
Yeah. We never did. No, on that first trip out in 63, the Muskeg went down a hole I was driving. That was a bit hairy, actually, because I was following Cuddles Jayon, and he was, I don't know whether you know, the crossing between the inland, the shelf ice and the inland ice is about 15, 18 miles across, but the actual route that you take to miss all the crevasses and all the rest of it takes about 26 miles altogether. And on each flag, you've got a compass bearing to the next flag. So if you see a flag there, you can't, until you take a bearing, you don't know whether it's that one or that one sort of thing. Anyway, he'd come up onto this flag, and I was 10 yards behind him or something like that. And suddenly, the muskeg went, and I ended up in the corner right over, this was the big cab ones, and I actually bent a piece of Dexian with my elbow. Oh, I didn't break, really. Well, not the Dexian, my elbow. And I had Neddy Brind was with me. He was the radar mechanic, but he was coming out on this trip. And the muskeg had gone in like at an angle like that, and I looked up through the back window, and they could see, because we mounted the petrol tanks quite high up above the engine, they could see this petrol coming out. We'd just filled up, actually. And you could see this petrol coming out of the filler cap. I said, quick, switch the engine off. And he was the nearest to the switch. I was just still clambering out of the... And he had switched it off, and he'd gone. He said, that's not going to happen on the way back, is it? I said, bloody hope not. Anyhow, we put a long wire onto the other muskeg and to hold it there so it wouldn't go any further down. The A-frame at the back of the sledge, that was holding it, actually. There was nothing we could do about it, so we got onto base. We managed to get through on the radio, which was quite spectacular, really, because we weren't far away, really, 20 miles. And they came out next day, two days actually, because we had a bit of a blow. And with the help of another muskeg, we pulled it out. But that was a bit hairy while it was all going on, you know.
Were you lucky to live?
Well, I mean, if it had gone down, if I'd been another 5 yards that way, because it opened the crevasse up, you could see, there's a big hole there. Nothing underneath it, you couldn't see anything at all. Water further down.
did that change your approach to what you were doing in the Antarctic?
Yeah, I walked about on tiptoe after that, yeah. No, it took us a long... It must have changed completely that winter, actually, as to what it was earlier on. And it took us about another fortnight to get across, actually. We skied most of it, Douglas and myself, and we had to reroute the whole thing.
What, you've met a lot of FIDs in your time. One or two may stand out. But what is it about them? What's the common factor about FIDs? What's special about them?
I don't know. They all believe in what they're doing, sort of thing. Or most of them believe in what they're doing. Most of them want to be down there. They used to say at one time they'd have gone down there without being paid, sort of thing, you know. But I don't know. Most of them get on with one another. I suppose they're easygoing sort of people. Yeah.
One or two people I've spoken to say it was the best years of their life.
Well, I think it is for most of them, yeah. It changed their lives, a lot of them, yeah.
It changed yours?
Well, yeah, I stopped being a mechanic working in a garage and became something different, yeah. Yeah, it changed mine completely, really.
You were involved for 45 years.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
45 years?
35, yeah.
As a
yeah.
fit?
No, not as a fit.
But,
20,
with bus?
26 years.
With bus? No, 26, sorry, yeah, 45, sorry.
Did it change your psychologically, your psyche, your...
Which what?
Did it change you internally? Did it become a stronger man, or... Was there something about it which has stayed with you? On a subtle level, has it changed you?
Yeah, I don't know, really. It's, I don't know whether it's changed me or not, really. I suppose it must have done, to a certain extent, but I don't know.
You can drink gin better than you used to.
Eh?
You can drink gin better than you used to.
Well, is that, yeah.
You
That takes a bit of doing as well.
Yeah, it does, yeah, practice.
Okay, one final thing. You have a Fuchs medal.
Yeah.
In 1984. Tell me about that. Why? What happened? Why the award?
I don't know. It's the Fuchs medal is you get that from all the rest of the fits thinking you're a good bloke, sort of.
Contemporary.
Oh. I don't know, they must have thought I was worth it.
Are you proud of it?
Oh, yeah.
Did you retire from Bass, or did you have another job afterwards?
No, I retired, actually, in 88. Went down again in 89 because they were rebuilding the base and using the army.
At Halley.
Yeah, and one of the lads... They were on manoeuvres in Germany, the army, before they went there. And one of the lads broke his ankle or leg or something and couldn't go. So they said, do I want to go down as a driver? Just as an ordinary driver. Same money. So I said, yeah. It's different life, isn't it? It's a different thing altogether. Jump at a chance. I wouldn't jump at a chance to go down again now, no. I think it's changed completely now to what it was. You got health and safety and stuff like that down.
You don't have a fit these days.
You wouldn't be able to do half the stuff we did.
Different breed down there now, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I think the lads are still the same. It's the thing that's changed, the organisation's changed. It had to, I suppose.
Alan, thank you very much indeed.